From WVUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 76-year-old Jiang Zemin has led China's Communist Party for more than a decade, and under the Secretary General, China has undergone a period of unprecedented economic growth. To the world beyond the Great Wall, the Chinese economy is the glitz and glamour of its booming supercities. But beneath the glass and chrome Shanghai skyline, China is trying to strike a difficult balance between communist politics and capitalist economics. Our guest tonight says maintaining that balance is pushing China into a crisis of governance. The cold and simple truth, he says, is that a Marxist government cannot forever lead a market economy. The longer it tries, the more it tempts corruption and collapse. With Jiang Zemin soon to step aside, China's future and the West's involvement there depend on how the country's new leaders deal with an inexorable crisis of governance. Listeners, can China be a communist and capitalist country at the same time? Should the U.S. view China as a partner or a threat? And with the Communist Party at the helm, but a market economy powering the ship, what is the future for China? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now is Minxin Pei, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's author of China's Governance Crisis in the September issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. Good evening and welcome, Minxin Pei.
Good evening to you.
Thanks so much for being with us. Also with us from the studios of Vermont Public Radio is On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom.
Minxin. Hi, Jack.
Hi, Minxin. How are you? I very much enjoyed your article.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, that's great. Minxin Pei, you lay out a provocative thesis in your piece in Foreign Affairs. You point out and don't deny that China has had some tremendous economic successes, but you also point out that it's done that under a Communist Party leadership, and you say that sooner or later, this partnership, this pairing, is going to break down. You even discuss the possibility eventually of a revolution if China tries to break out of this ungainly partnership with reforms that go awry. Most of us look at China, we see a booming economy, we see those skyscrapers in Shanghai and all the products pouring out of there, and see what seems to be a rather formidable success. Where do you see the weakness?
Well, the biggest weakness is in its political system, because despite this tremendous economic growth and integration with the international market, Chinese politics remains little changed in its most important respects, especially in the area of where power is derived and how power is used in China.
You describe this marriage of the party and the market system as dot communism. I know it's partly facetious, but what are you trying to convey there?
I'm trying to say that this kind of market economy that we see in China is quite superficial. It's superficial because it does not have the foundations of the rule of law and political openness. Without a rule of law or political accountability, that kind of system can easily degenerate into crony capitalism. And as we know from the experience in Southeast Asia, especially Indonesia, crony capitalism is unsustainable.
Why then does it look so strong so far? It's been very favorably compared to the Soviet efforts to move to a market economy. The growth rates have been tremendous. People are talking about China as the coming superpower. Why all this view of success if it's so deeply flawed?
Well, we are not denying that certain parts of the Chinese economy and certain parts of China have done very well, mostly because in these areas, foreign investment, local entrepreneurship have been successfully married together to produce a very dynamic economy. But also, we must see that in other parts of China, in other industrial sectors, especially in the countryside, and in those state-owned enterprises, basic problems of property rights, of government ownership, have not been resolved. And these parts of the economy are eventually going to drag down the most dynamic parts of the Chinese economy.
What are the symptoms you see, Minxin Pei, of problems in the Chinese marriage of Marxism and market?
There are several problems and symptoms. The biggest symptom that we see today is corruption. Corruption has reached an unprecedented scale in China because the political power controlled by the Chinese government is not subject to any control by the population. And if power is not constrained by rules, we know the power will breed corruption.
Corruption's number one, but are the Chinese simply tolerating it? Is it a symptom that may lead to the kind of breakdown that you describe?
I do not think the Chinese people tolerate that kind of corruption. They may not have, at the moment, effective means to control corruption. That does not mean that they accept corruption. Corruption is getting less and less intolerable in China because inequality in China is rising, and also more and more people in China are not getting as well off as other as their neighbors. So in that kind of situation, people's tolerance of corruption is expected to decline rather than stay the same. And if that's the case, we're going to see much more public resentment against corruption.
Jack Beattie, Minxin Pei lays out a provocative thesis and vision here that's quite at odds with what I perceive to be the way China is understood in Washington and around most of the United States. It's the coming superpower. It's a potential strategic competitor to the United States. There's been a lot of talk about an inevitable or eventual clash of the interests of these two great powers. Minxin Pei is describing a deeply internally flawed China that might fall apart before it ever reaches that kind of status.
Yeah, in Minxin's rendering, to mix our metaphors, their economy and their vaunted achievements look sort of like Potemkin achievements. And, you know, what really strikes me, I mean, in other words, I think there's been a lot of vested interest in China's reputation. That is, Western businessmen have been interested in, you know, doing deals there, and so they talk about the great Chinese economy. Our government, before Iraq and before September 11th, Rumsfeld and Cheney were, you know, certainly ready to take a hard line with China, justifying our defense apparatus. So China has served a lot in the American imagination, not just recently, but for a long time, has been the left has projected fantasies of equality and, you know, rice roots democracy on China. And the right has seen, you know, oh, my gosh, the China market. And I think this has tended to cloud American perceptions. What do you think about that, Minxin?
Well, I think so. I think in certain circles in Washington, they see China for what they want to see China. The right-wingers in Washington see China primarily in terms of a military threat, and the business community sees China as a market, and the labor unions also perceive China as a threat to their jobs. But very few people have taken China at what it is really, which is a very diverse place and a country that has very serious political flaws. Those political flaws will eventually slow down China's growth.
Minxin Pei, Jack Beattie, stand by. I want to welcome another voice into our conversation. We're joined in the studio now by Jeffrey Muir. He's director of Asia-Pacific Government Relations for Vivendi Universal. He's a longtime China hand, if we can still use that phrase, who's been both a student of China and an American businessman in the Chinese orbit for going on 30 years now. Good evening and welcome, Jeffrey Muir.
Good evening, Tom.
It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
Jeff Muir, you've heard Minxin Pei's thesis here saying that China it may look like a business dynamo, may look like a mounting superpower, but in fact that old label from decades ago, sick man of Asia, may come around to haunt it again, that it's got a kind of problem baked into its formula here of Communist Party leadership and market economy that is going to come back to haunt it. Do you buy this interpretation of China? You're out there doing business in China, watching others do it in China. Do you see it as flawed as Minxin Pei describes?
Perhaps in a way that might surprise people, I do. Actually, I've read Minxin Pei's piece. I think it's quite accurate in its analysis of the problems of China. The one area that I might disagree a little bit in is the rather unidimensional description of the business community's attitude about this. Quite honestly, people who have been on the ground for a long time doing business with China are not quite as enamored with it as people might think in the United States. It's not uncommon among business people for us to debate the question, when are we ever going to make money in China? The idea that it's this great golden goose that we're all deriving wonderful golden eggs from is really not the reality. And I think many of the things that Mr. Pei saw and sees in China, I completely agree with. It's a question, to me, of a matter of timing. Are we going to be in a situation where this crisis builds to a point, the pressure builds to a point that we see something in the short term? I'm less supportive of
that. See something by which you mean some kind of crisis, some kind of breakdown.
A convulsive crisis that would cause a revolution. Medium to long term, I think he has some very, very good points. And I guess as a person who lives in Hong Kong, which is now part of China, while I agree with the analysis, I fear it because I think a convulsive China would be a very, very dangerous element in Asia and in the world.
We'll talk about that. But, Jeff Murray, I want to put one question to you. You say that the business community also has a fair degree of skepticism, but it has been an enormous magnet for foreign direct investment. Just last year, I think the total put into China by foreign investors was $46 billion. People are pouring a lot of money into this country if, in fact, it's sitting on some kind of political, economic fault line.
Yeah, I think you're right, Tom, in that the business community does not see this as a short-term issue that's going to suddenly go over the side, and hence there's been the investment. WTO accession reinvigorated investment into China. And I think there is, and I would agree with Mr. Pei, that there is a certain amount of rose-colored glasses look at this. But basically, one should not think that the business community is totally on board with the idea of a stable China forever. Probably peaceful evolution might be more what many business people think. I think that Mr. Pei is right. It will be difficult to have that type of peaceful evolution with as many contradictions in the society as we see.
Minxin Pei, what about it? Jeff Muir says, yes, we've got problems here, but they may play out over a very long time. Could it be that during that time, China will actually have a kind of political evolution, pull this together? Are we discounting the possibility of China making good on this awkward mix?
Oh, yeah. I think the central point of my article is not that China faces an imminent crisis. Rather, this kind of governance crisis is structural in nature, and it will affect China's long-term prospects. I do not see, say, within the next 3 to 5 years, any serious possibility of a collapse. In fact, I think China will be superficially quite stable.
But you quote Alex de Tocqueville saying that repressive regimes are most likely to be overthrown when they try to reform themselves. It seems to paint a picture where China's damned if it does and damned if it doesn't. If it goes down this line, it's untenable. If it tries to reform, revolution.
I use that quote to illustrate another point, that is, the longer the reforms are delayed, the more risky it becomes when reforms are implemented. So if the Chinese government confronts this dangerous reality and starts incrementally moving toward a more open society, implementing some democratic reforms, I think the chances are pretty good that it will eventually make it. But because of this succession problem that hangs over the Chinese leadership in the next 3 to 5 years, we probably are going to miss this golden opportunity.
Minxin Pei, Jeff Muir, Jack Beatty, stand by. We're talking tonight about China's dot-communism and asking if it can last. We're going to come back and look at the succession issues that China is facing squarely right now. How far can China take capitalism under communism? Is China's political evolution too fast, too slow, just right? Can a capitalist country have one-party rule without massive corruption? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China's dot-communism, its unique mix of Marxism and market economy, and asking how far it can go, how long it can last. How far can China take capitalism under communism? Is China a good and steady world partner for the United States? And can you imagine another revolution in China? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guests tonight are Min-Hsien Pei. He's a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of China's Governance Crisis in the September issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. And by Jeffrey Muir, he's director of Asia-Pacific Government Relations for Vivendi Universal, a longtime student of China and businessman in China. You can join us as well at 1-800-423-8255. Jeff Muir, Min-Hsien Pei mentioned just before the break the succession issue that's facing China right now. And, of course, you've had Jiang Zemin as head of the Communist Party, president of China, and as effectively head of the military, chairman of the military commission. We are now looking at a transfer of power. It's said to be that Hu Jintao is in line, the vice president of China, but, of course, there are many others, and it's been a kind of nudgy one step forward, two steps back process. Where are we in that process right now? And does it appear that China is poised to have an effective transfer of power?
Well, I think the leadership has been spending the last several weeks in Beidaihe, one of their resorts, trying to hammer this out. Those of us who've been watching China for a long time are quite skeptical that we're going to see today, Jiang Zemin in leadership. Tomorrow, Hu Jintao in leadership. Jiang Zemin is going to be in the background for quite a long time. Frankly, the debate in the last few weeks has been just how much Jiang is going to give up. I think the current wisdom is that he will not give up his military position. He may give up. He's likely to give up his presidential position. The party chairmanship is a bit up in the air. I would say if he doesn't give up the party chairmanship, then that would indicate a real tension in the whole succession process.
Min-Hsien Pei, to your mind, what does this difficulty in transfer of power say about China's stability, about the prospects for reform?
I think the biggest threat to China's stability and future prospects from this messy transfer of power is that many key decisions will not be made. You're going to have a paralysis of policy in Beijing. In the meantime, the kind of problems I describe in my article, namely corruption, a deteriorating public finance picture, and also rising tensions between the government and its people, are going to get worse. And that will threaten China's long-term prospects.
Jeff Muir, Jiang Zemin has been famous in China for his three represents policy. It seems like every Chinese leader has to have a kind of a one, two, three or slogan that they leave as their legacy. This is attempting to be, is it not, a marriage of party and market interests?
It's an attempt to bring in the capitalist elements of the economy into the party. I would agree with what Min-Hsien has said in his article about the cynicism that this has bred in among the population. One doesn't have to spend too much time in China to hear the people speak of the three represents in a way that suggests that they don't see Jiang Zemin as a theoretician on the level of a Mao Zedong or even a Deng Xiaoping.
So the cynicism is because they don't see these as really a profound point, or because there's something flawed in the vision?
I think they see it as something flawed in the vision. It's not a profound point. Jack made the comment of saying a Potemkin-type situation. I feel that the three represents the efforts to bring capitalists into the party is essentially this creation of a Potemkin village-type government where we're all going to work together, capitalists and communists, without any contradictions. If that's the case, somebody's got to change. Either the communists are going to change or the capitalists are going to change.
And yet, Min-Hsien Pei, isn't it the case that across China, capitalist and communist party leaders are arm in arm all over the place?
Oh, that's true. That's the most ironic aspect of politics in contemporary China. I think it is no longer accurate to say the Chinese communists are really communists. They are not. If you analyze their policies and look at their social basis of support, this is a very capitalist ruling regime. It has nothing to do with the principles of communism. What it's really said about the three represents in the Chinese case is that the people who need to represent, need to be represented most, the workers and the peasants, are not in the three represents. They don't have any political voice inside China today.
So what you're describing is really just a one-party system that's looking after its own interests, not necessarily any ideology.
Exactly. It's a very self-serving, non-ideological, pragmatic regime. It's not an ideological regime.
But we heard Jiang Zemin just on July 1st in his speech say, we must resolutely resist the impact of Western political models, such as the multi-party system or separation of powers among the executive, legislative, and judicial branches. This does not sound, Min Xinpei, like a leader who's chomping at the bit for democratic reform.
Certainly does not, rhetorically speaking. This does not rule out, however, small steps that the party might take in order to preserve political stability. For example, in the area of legal reform, the party would allow commercial laws to be introduced and to some extent respected. The party would allow ordinary citizens to sue the police, to sue the local governments for violations of their rights so that the citizens think that the law sometimes works for them. However, on the fundamental issue of whether China ought to have different political forces competing in an open public area for office, I think the Communist Party's position is very clear. It does not want that kind of situation to happen.
Jack Beattie, this has been something that China's never accomplished. Is it too much to expect China to evolve into a thriving democratic polity, even as its market economy grows?
Well, I think the Western model has been that the market economy would do that, that somehow what Minchin calls the contradictions, the Marxist word, would just become too great, and the integument, if you will, of the party, to use Marx's language, would burst, and you'd that would do it. You know, so changing it from within. Someone once asked FDR, "How would he change Russia?" He said, "I'd give everybody the Sears Roebuck catalog." And I think that's been sort of the implicit idea we're having. But Minchin, you're showing us really, I think that idea may not be it may not produce the evolution that we're thinking of, because this regime has been stripped of its ideological justifications and now is sort of a naked power grab. I mean, only 15% of the people now believe in communism, you say, and 70% think that the pursuit of individual happiness should be the highest goal, and all this corruption hastening this institution, this ideological and institutional decay. It sounds like that the contradictions are there, but it may not be so pleasant for Western business. I think you're sort of saying that, aren't you? That the basic state, the basic tasks of a state here may be incipiently collapsing in China.
Well, I see that without resolving those contradictions, that is how you maintain an open society and a market economy while trying to preserve a monopolistic political party. You are going to, in the end, weaken the government's ability to govern because the party has its own interests. The state has its separate interests, and the people have their own interests. How do you mash these different interests together? In the West, you have a political process. In China, it is the will of a ruling oligarchy that decides who should get what and how much from the system. And that's really not in step with the Chinese society today, because the Chinese people are much more aware of their rights, are much more knowledgeable about how politics works in other countries. Mm.
And yet it's not exactly unprecedented in Asian countries that have seen powerful economies. I want to turn to our callers. We're talking about China's dot communism and asking, can it last? We're at 1-800-423-8255. George is on the line. Welcome, George. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
Yeah, my question to your guest is, a lot of countries in Asia, like Singapore and South Korea, they are all, when they have very high growth in economy, they are all end one party's government. Is why China can have this model to have successful in economy?
Well, it's a good question and a tough one, Min Xinpei.
Okay,
you saw in
well.
Japan for many years, the LDP was the only party that ruled. It's not the only Asian country that's had that kind of situation. What makes China's one-party rule different?
Okay, several points here. First of all, size matters. One-party system can be sustained in smaller units.
Japan is the second largest economy in the world.
Slightly different case because there you have a mixture of popular of participatory democratic politics, but a one-party democratic system, which is oxymoron. But that's the case. In the case of Singapore, you have a city-state which is non-democratic, but in that state there is some kind of rule of law which controls the behavior of the people in power. As a result, that city-state is not corrupt because corruption will destroy the economy sooner or later. In the case of Korea, when economic development reached a certain level in the mid-1980s, the people there demanded democracy, and the ruling elite saw that it was in their self-interest to open up the political system. So South Korea went almost overnight from a military dictatorship to a democratic system.
Of course, there was a lot of blood and tear gas involved in that changeover.
Well, that's still a lot better than the collapse of the former Soviet Union.
Yes, without question. George, it is a great question, though, and we thank you for bringing it to us. Jeff Muir, I want to put to you this issue of, on the ground, how this alliance between the party and business works in China. Can you give us some concrete examples of how the two live, work, profit side by side?
By business, Tom, do you mean foreign business or domestic business?
Well, you make the distinction.
Let's first talk about domestic. I think one of the interesting elements of China has been what has been the root of the capitalist side, the domestic capitalist side, and perhaps this is – I'll go on to explain that a bit, but perhaps this is why there hasn't been a convulsive or a contradictory relationship between this emerging capitalist class and the Communist Party, in that, you look, who are these capitalists? Many of them are former Communist Party officials, cadres and managers of plants that suddenly declared themselves capitalists one day, and many of the people I work with come from party government roots and have crossed over the line.
So they're still comrades, even if they're on the capitalist
right.
side.
And hence, they aren't as antagonistic. I've been quite surprised with the number of returning students that have come back from the United States and from Europe. One might think that they, now having been imbued with more Western democratic trends, would become a real counterbalance to the government. My feeling is, with a few notable exceptions, they've looked more to get on the gravy train.
That means join the party and get into business.
If not join the party, at least coexist with the party.
Mm-hmm.
Look to make accommodations with the party. Another very important group is who are a lot of the leaders of companies are the children of the government leaders. Are they likely to become revolutionaries against their parents? No. So I think for all those elements, we haven't had a true communist-capitalist contradiction there. I agree very much with what Min Xin is saying. The one or two groups that are left out of this equation very dangerously are the workers and the peasants. They are getting the short end of the stick.
Min Xinpei, how might the Chinese workers and peasants at the short end of the stick find their voice, find political power?
I think at the moment there are no institutional channels in China that will allow them to become politically powerful or have their interests represented. So at right now, they can only take the form of violence to express their unhappiness.
And you say there are areas of rural China where government officials are essentially afraid to go.
There are certain parts of rural China that have become effectively anarchies because their parents are sick and tired of paying taxes and getting nothing in return. And they cannot, in many cases, they cannot afford to pay taxes because Chinese agricultural prices, prices for Chinese agricultural products have been stagnant. And their income has remained quite low for the last few years.
Bruce is on the line. Bruce, welcome. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks.
Sure.
Yeah, I want to take issue with one comment that was made about the corruption being at unprecedented levels.
All right.
I really find that hard to believe. I mean, if you look
in what
back,
sense, Bruce?
Well, just look back in the history of China. The Manchus were, I mean, the corruption there was horrendous. Even I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, the Kuomintang,
became
a nationalist. You know, at first they were welcomed by the people because they wouldn't, they didn't go in and rape and pillage and steal. But eventually, what happened is the culture of corruption took them over.
But Bruce, are you suggesting that because China has had corruption in its history, that it can succeed in a modern global market economy with large-scale corruption today?
No, what I'm saying is they have to find a solution to get rid of that corruption. It could be an external impetus, you know, all the foreign students that are coming back in. It could be a return to Buddhism, with their non-materialistic values.
Let's put that to Minxin Pei. And well, Bruce, thank you for your call. Minxin Pei.
Well, Bruce raises a very interesting question. That is, how big a problem it is in China today as far as corruption is concerned. We don't have historical data for the magnitude of corruption in the Qing Dynasty, the last imperial dynasty in China. We do not have data for corruption under the last, the old regime, the Kuomintang, the nationalists. But we've heard from anecdotal reports in China from people who actually lived under Kuomintang, and their complaints are the Communist Party is more corrupt than Kuomintang. I have done some statistical studies of corruption in China. Of course, my methodology can be challenged.
Minxin Pei, hold the statistic. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight about China's dot communism and asking, can it last? Is China a good and steady world partner for the United States? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about China and China's dot communism, its unique mixture of one-party rule and market economics, and asking, can it last? And what might be the consequences if it cannot? Is China a good and steady world partner for the United States? Can you imagine another revolution in China? If China's Communist Party rejects multi-party democracy, does that matter to you? Does it matter to the world? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by Jeffrey Muir, Director of Asia-Pacific Government Relations for Vivendi Universal and a longtime student of China and American business in China, and by Minxin Pei, a Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And Minxin Pei, you were describing just before the break your statistical analysis of corruption in China, and I was struck by your opening comment there that China's Communist Party corruption you would now deem larger than the corruption of the Kuomintang that the Communist Party famously threw out because it was corrupt. How do you gauge the level of corruption in this country today?
Well, I used some official sources to estimate the magnitude of corruption, and I came up with the figure that corruption defined in terms of bribery taken by government officials theft from government coffers, mm-hmm. smuggling, and so on and so forth, amounted to about 3 to 4% of GDP a year. That's about $30 billion.
Put that in a context for us, if you can. Does that make it one of the most corrupt economies in the world? Medium, small?
Well, it's hard to say, because not many countries have that kind of number. But if you use Corruption Perception Index, which is published by Transparency International, mm-hmm. an international NGO in Berlin, China has been ranked in the bottom quartile in the countries of the world.
Does that mean it's especially good or especially bad?
Very bad, among us at the bottom of the pile, in the company of Nigeria, Indonesia, and Russia, that distinguished group.
And that with an economy of this great dimension. Jeff Muir, you know how the Communist Party came into being, and the reputation of the Communist Party in its many early decades was just the opposite of this.
Absolutely. And I think that's why the population is reacting so poorly to the growth of corruption. Corruption takes many, many different forms in China. Large-scale corruption, as Minxin has said, sort of stealing from the government coffers, smuggling. But it also takes a very micro level. You want to get medical care. Things like this. It's increasingly for the Chinese people at each point that they interact with the government on whatever level, it's going to cost them money. And they know that and they don't like it. They feel that somehow the party's gone very, very wrong.
And this from the party that famously wouldn't even take a needle and thread from a house that it stayed in, where wallets would be returned and everything was upright and honest. Jack Beatty, It's hard to see exactly how the United States can influence this picture, especially since we no longer have the most favored nation trading status cudgel held over China's head.
It really is, and I'd be interested to hear what our guests think about that. I just wanted to mention one question. Hannah Arendt says that the foundations of totalitarianism are ideology to motivate people and terror to frighten them. Well, you've shown us how the extent of ideological decay in China. What about the apparatus of terror? You yourself have felt it in your own life, as I well know.
Well, I think China today uses a strategy, what I would call selective repression. That is, the government leaves most of the people alone. Personal freedom in China has expanded tremendously. However, if you want to challenge the authority of the ruling party, then you put your liberty in jeopardy. And those who dare to stand up to the government have been ruthlessly repressed.
What's your experience with this repression, Min Xinpei, personally?
I grew up in China during the Cultural Revolution. I was spared because I was quite young, but I witnessed a period of mass repression in China, mainly from 1966 to 1976. About 100 million people in China, almost 15 to 20% of the population were affected. My family was affected. My parents were at one point put in camps. But luckily they survived. I have neighbors mm-hmm. who did not survive. Mm. But today I think China is a very different place. That kind of political madness is history. Mm. Today the government uses a much more pragmatic and targeted approach to maintaining its power.
Jeff Muir, Min Xinpei describes selective repression, and there's no doubt that's at work. But we've also seen over time in China another inhibitor on political upheaval, and that is, a fear bred over many centuries in the Chinese populace of chaos and the consequences of chaos.
I think you're right, Tom, and that's something that has been helpful to them in terms of creating a sense of caution on the part of the population in terms of taking on the government.
So it's been helpful to the party in holding power.
Absolutely. The Soviet Union, what is described as the collapse of the Soviet Union, is described over and over again in China as this is what happens if the political process is allowed to change too quickly, and people buy into it. I think Minxin is – I like the term selective repression. When I deal with people in China, and I deal both in the countryside and in the cities, the degree of personal freedom is much greater. I have friends in China. 25 years ago, that was a ridiculous concept. But we don't get on ticklish political issues. Once you go public with a political position, you risk calling the wrath of the government down on your head.
And it's there, and it's ready. Tom is on the line. Welcome, Tom. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, given that the Communist Party keeps such a tight control over the military and of the media, then do our guests feel that it's realistic that in this decade or perhaps even the next, we might see anything like a collapse of the presiding system as opposed to an exchange of power from one oligarchy to the next oligarchy? And if we might see that, then where would it come from and how would it come about?
Tom, that's a great question. You take us right to the bottom line. Minxin Pei, you expressed some hope that there could be reform over time that would avoid that. But if there's not sufficient reform, if the tensions you describe build up, what about Tom's question? Where does the threat to this one-party rule come from? What kind of scenario might unfold?
I think the most likely scenario for China is long-term stagnation. If the government does not pursue the kind of political reforms that will make China a truly open society. I think risks for collapse will increase gradually because these problems are going to get worse rather than better. And depending on the kind of economic performance China has in the future, you will have very different outcomes. I'm averse to making specific predictions, but should the kind of events we saw in 1989, when there was truly a national revolution for democracy,
the year of Tiananmen,
should that kind of situation happen again in China, I doubt whether the Chinese government will have the ability to put that down.
So then if there were some upheaval, you're describing not an organized party to take on the Communist Party, but rather a kind of spontaneous or popular uprising as a potential scenario.
Yes, I think that's a much more likely scenario than organized opposition group taking over the Chinese Communist Party. Should that happen, I think China will indeed descend into chaos. That's not a happy outcome for anybody. The cost for the Chinese people will be tremendous.
But I'm fascinated because, and Tom, thank you for your call and your good question, but I'm fascinated, Minxin Pei, by your notion that the more likely path is stagnation. What are the consequences for China and for the world if we have a future of stagnation rather than the kind of robust growth we've come to associate with that country?
I think that will make China a truly very interesting place to watch because those who fear that China will become a military giant will be disappointed, and those who think that China will be the world's second largest economy will also be disappointed. You're going to see a very messy China. China will be a difficult place to do business in. Human rights, they are not going to improve. And you're going to have problems with non-traditional kinds of threats, such as illegal immigration, narcotics trafficking, the spread of AIDS, all those problems that will make China's neighbors, as well as, I think, the United States, feel a different kind of threat.
The spinoff of a disorderly, stagnant society. John is on the line. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Hi there.
Hi.
Fascinating discussion. I'd just like to bring the question back to foreign investment in China and the effect of a legal system that doesn't protect investment.
Mm-hmm.
Just to give you some background, I work with a company that analyzes retailers around the world, and I know that recently Carrefour, for instance, which is invested in China and expected great growth, had like local permission for expansion and additional operations and stores. It turned out that they didn't have national permission, and suddenly they found themselves restricted in their investment. And, you know, what's going to happen to the state of foreign investment if there isn't a clarity that protects people's investment in the country?
John, you put your finger right on a long-term issue, and thank you for the call and question. Jeff Muir, here it is. There's never been a structure of laws that people in or outside China could depend on. As Minxin Pei writes, it's the rule not of laws but of men. What are the implications in terms of ongoing foreign economic involvement in China if we have this kind of continuing cloud of legal maze and lack of law?
I think the long-term outlook is actually not very good. There's a very interesting development, excuse me, prior to WTO. And there had been at that point, most businesses had gone in gone into China with the idea of, we have to be in China. We have to have market share in China. If we don't have it, we're dead come 20 years from now when China turns into the dynamic economy that some people see. A lot of that market share investment, the cynicism about it is very, very strong. The Carrefour example is a correct one. There are many. Ask Motorola how they feel once they started to make profit and then things became difficult for them. WTO reinvigorated that idea because a lot of people, and perhaps in a naive way, have felt that WTO was somehow going to introduce that element of law into the system.
That China was joining world norms.
Right, world norms. Now, it's still early days, but I think one has to view that with a certain degree of caution.
Meaning, people have learned lessons, and even WTO membership hasn't made it better. People have lost money, and you're seeing probably this pipeline of money flowing in from outside not continuing if it doesn't get better.
Well, I would give them a little more time on WTO before I pull the plug on it, but that's what's reinvigorated the investment flow. But I think this time there's a little bit of, you know, fool me once, okay, fool me twice, not okay. And I think you'll find that foreign business as it goes forward will concentrate a little less on market share and a little more on what profit they actually make in the market.
Minxin Pei, our time grows short. What single thing or a couple of things should we look for as evidence that China is recognizing the problem you describe and acting to correct it?
Well, I would put down several markers. First of all, I think they can do something about this messy transition. If they have learned, if Chinese leaders have learned anything from the Soviet collapse, that is, one generation of leaders stays too long in power. And if they can hand over power in a very clean fashion this time, that can send a very powerful signal to the Chinese people and to the rest of the world. And the second one is that they should start moving slowly but surely toward expanding some positive reforms that were implemented in the 90s, for example.
Minxin Pei, we don't have time for the details, but we'll bring you back for them. It was so great to have you tonight. Thank you for joining us on Point. Minxin Pei is Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's author of China's Governance Crisis in the September issue of Foreign Affairs Magazine. And Jeffrey Muir, old friend, good to see you again, and thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom.
Jeffrey Muir is Director of Asia-Pacific Government Relations for Vivendi Universal. Jack Beattie, final thought?
The title of Minxin's new book is called China Trapped in Transition. Says it all, I think.
That does says it all. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.